She sent him about trying to get.
We'll open up the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Wednesday, May 20th. We're going to go a little out of order. We're going to start by opening a work session on House Bill 2247. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, this is the bill that you heard last week that allows the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to suspend liquor licenses for failure to comply with liquor liability insurance or surety bond requirements. You have no amendments?
Okay, we had asked for some clarity from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, so Tom, you want to come forward? And the question, colleagues, as you remembered, and we talked about the validity of the tool, but we were concerned about how it would be implemented and make sure it would be not be used as a hammer. And so that's kind of how we'd like to have you address how the OSCC would utilize this tool. So with that in mind, welcome.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Linda.
For the record, I'm Linda Ignowski from the Regulatory Services Director for the Commission. I'm a little out of breath. I had to run across the mall, so we're a little late with that traffic. Anyway, Chairman Metzger, I should have come here last week. I didn't realize it, you know, you had some questions. I'd be happy to answer.
We always have questions in this committee.
I know. So this tool is adding our ability to do an immediate suspension for someone who doesn't have liquor liability insurance. I think you were concerned about how it would use this. The immediate suspensions, how this would work is that we get notifications from insurance companies. We don't actively go search out this and check every person for liquor liability. We are named as a certificate holder for liquor liability. So when somebody gets notice of cancellation or non-renewal, we get notification too. We did some checking on the companies, most of the companies that do that, and they do give ranging from 10 to 35 to 45 days notice to the licensee. So it's not a new thing that their liquor liability may be canceled or not renewed. And so some give a 45-day window, some give 30, and some give only 10 days if it's for non-payment. Once we get those, which we usually get probably the same time the licensee gets it, they are still in compliance because they have liquor liability. We usually give them a call just to make sure they realize that we got notice that their liquor liability is possibly going to be canceled. They usually tell us what's going on, and we wait to hear confirmation. So the day after that, it was supposed to be canceled, we'll call and see if they've rectified it. A lot of it's due to non-payment. They just didn't pay it. And so if they've paid it and they've got the rider, it's no longer an issue. What I think one of the concerns was that if we perchance did an immediate suspension, we found somebody's out of compliance for a period of time, we would do an immediate suspension. It takes us about a week, maybe 2 weeks, to do the report, to get the letter over to our administrative process, to get them to write the letter to send out for an immediate suspension. So there's at least a 7-day window by the time our inspectors find out about it, till they write the report, till it gets to a letter, and then has to be sent out. An immediate suspension, anytime somebody has rectified that situation, we can withdraw the immediate suspension. So there's no long administrative process. There's no hearings that have to go to. They show us proof that they have the insurance. We withdraw our immediate suspension and they don't have to serve it. If per chance they can't get it, they can't do it in the time, immediate suspensions are always given priority for administrative hearings. So the hearing would happen in 2 weeks. And so they would have the opportunity in a hearing in 2 weeks to put out their case for that. We've only in the past probably canceled maybe two or three licensees in the 13 years that I've been there, and basically it's because they couldn't find somebody that would insure them, and so they lost their liquor license. So that's kind of how we would do this.
Okay. Senator George, does that answer your questions? Okay. All right, we're in a work session on House Bill 2247.
Move the bill as is.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2247 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Verger, would you carry the bill?
Sure.
Okay. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2369.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2369 establishes that release for bodily injury obtained by motor vehicle liability insurer within 60 days of motor vehicle accident does not preclude personal injury insurer from recovering payments made for medical benefits from the motor vehicle liability insurer. This is a subrogation bill. You have the dash A5. Amendment which authorizes motor vehicle liability insurers to obtain release from eligible persons with inclusion of clear and conspicuous notice of conclusion of claim. It allows the eligible person to rescind the release if notice is provided to the insurer within 5 days of the execution of the release. We have the required paperwork on the dash A5 should you wish to move
okay.
it with dash A5.
Thank you, Mr. Stambridge. And colleagues, the dash 5 is mine. It was something we were actually working on with the bill originally and waited, we said, to get it over here. We would put that in with support of the industry. And with that, John Powell and Vern Sable, if you want to come forward. All right, just for the two of you. That's yeah, Steve, yeah. Okay, Linda. Linda, good to see you. You're becoming a regular. Okay. Please.
Chair, Mr. and members of the committee, for the record, Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance. Just to kind of give some background on the Ian Gross version of 2369 to begin with, when you're in an automobile accident, you have your own insurance, and there's the liability insurance for the at-fault person, and there's an interrelationship between those two coverages. Essentially, an at-fault person is going to be responsible for eventually paying all your damages. Those damages, however, are only paid when you're ready to say, okay, I'm ready to settle my property claim, now I'm ready to settle my bodily injury claim, and you present all your components of those two different damage elements when you're ready to settle. In the process of settling, you also have your insurance company, which has personal injury protection coverage. That's a coverage that's mandated on every policy that's sold in the state of Oregon. It provides for medical coverage, lost wages, some funeral benefits, if you're not working, for household assistance. In order to have that coverage, that your company pays that without regard to fault immediately. It starts paying your bills and paying your other damages that you have that are applicable to that coverage. When your claim is concluded, they will go back to the at-fault carrier and get their money back that they paid on your behalf, and so that then goes against your policy and credits back and reduces the whole cost of costing that coverage. You'll be able to get the other damages you have from that liability insurer. Now, the problem that we're addressing with 2369 as it's written is if you were to go out and early on in a claim settle with the at-fault party's insurer, you would be understanding most of the time that you're giving up your right to sue their customer, their insured. What you may not understand is early on the claim, by signing that release, you would also be preventing your insurance company from being able to go back and get money from the at-fault party. That would provide a discharge to your insurance company where they wouldn't have to pay your bills anymore. So to address that problem, what we've done is we've said if you settle a claim with a consumer, within the first 60 days following that accident, your release as a motor vehicle liability insurer, the at-fault party's insurer, has to include in it a provision that says it's not going to affect that person's ability to go to their own insurance company and get their personal injury protection benefits and get their bills paid. That's only for the first 60 days. After 60 days, that you don't have to have that provision in it because by that time, typically people are in a situation where they know where their claim is and they're not going to be in an early settlement making a mistake where maybe they need some more treatment. They'll have a better idea of where to go. That's what we passed out of the House. As Senator Metzger already told you, we knew this bill was coming over. He had a constituent who had another issue that we're addressing in the A5 amendments to the bill that we'd talked to House Consumer Protection, telling them we were addressing that. If it's okay, Senator, I can go into that amendment right now. Essentially, this is another, Senator Metzger's constituent had an issue where she had been approached about settlement shortly after an accident and may not have completely understood both what we're solving in the original bill and what this part of the bill does. If you're a motor vehicle liability insurer, you come to someone in person to settle, the A5 amendment will require you to do will require one thing and give a consumer a right to do another thing. What it will require is that you provide a clear and conspicuous statement that's in the block letters in the bill that says essentially that it's a binding contract that concludes the claim. Once you sign it, you're not going to be able to pursue any claim against the people that are released in that document. So it provides a clear and conspicuous statement. We put in the amendment that you could do that by incorporating that language either into the release you're taking or into a separate document to give insurance carriers some choice in how they complied. Even though this bill won't become effective until January 1, 2010, you could have some supply rooms that have quite a few releases still in them if people are using them in print form. And those releases would be need to be thrown out for Oregon and new ones printed and put in. But what we've done is that you can incorporate in the release or you can give it a separate document, either one. But you got to be able to have it and leave the insurance companies responsibility to prove that they provided that documentation. The second thing that it does is, again, it's limited to the situation where the release is taken in person, is it gives the consumer a right within 5 business days following execution of the release to rescind the release by giving written notice to the insurance carrier. And what we've provided in the bill is the written notice can either be through, you can show a proof of mailing within the 5 business days, or the proof of some sort of electronic transmission, because if you're using email to communicate with the insurer, those types of communications nowadays are given more effect like writing. And so you'd have 5 days to rescind it. That's what the A5 amendment does. State Farm favors both the A and Gross version of the bill and the A5 amendment. I've not had any pushback from any other insurers saying they do not favor the A5 amendment. With that, you can either I can either answer questions, or if you'd like to hear the witnesses, let us know what you'd like to hear.
Let's go ahead and have the other witnesses testify, and then we'll open up for questions.
Linda, you want to go?
No, you're okay. Go ahead.
Vern Stable, representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. I approached State Farm with some of these concepts. The primary one that we were concerned with is seeing a disruption of the doctor-patient relationship when a consumer unknowingly would sign off on a release with a third-party at-fault carrier. In other words, the insurer that struck that patient, for instance, in the rear, caused a whiplash injury that I'm actively treating them for, not realizing that now the first party PIP, their insurer, is concerned that they may not get reimbursed for payment of treatment, my treatment, by the at-fault carrier. And so many of the times would send the consumer a letter saying, well, you've made this third-party settlement. We're no longer going to pay for Dr. Stable's treatment because we're concerned we're not going to get reimbursed. This bill takes care of that. That was our primary concern. The disclosure piece was also of interest, and then also the 5-day, if they start really hurting, believe, in fact, that taking that settlement was possibly a mistake, but they have a chance to rescind that. There's one other piece that I'll mention briefly that was something that was very important to our Board of Chiropractic Examiners and the Oregon Chiropractic Association. That is the situation where we have certain vendors who offer their services to providers, to auto body shops, and to apparently attorney groups, and that is to have their agents obtain the crash injury reports from, for instance, the city of Portland, and then have their agents cold call these consumers who had been in a recent car accident. And we view it as not only unprofessional but unethical activity, and wanted a piece in there that would make it difficult to obtain those crash injury reports, which have your home address, your home telephone number, and very likely your license number. We got resistance from the ACLU and the newspapers and had to drop that piece. We are working with a House member of a different way of addressing the issue, but I want to go on the record and mention that. That is all that I have to say.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Minton, do you have anything to add?
I would love to if you...
Please.
My name is Lindy Minton, and thank you for letting me testify today. This issue is very personal to me. I was the person that actually contacted Senator Metzger May of last year. In fact, it'll be a year on Friday. I was rear-ended at about 40 miles per hour at a dead stop on I-5 by a truck hauling a flatbed with a caterpillar on it. Obviously, he wasn't able to stop. Unfortunately, our seats collapsed, and with the impact, he shot us into the truck that was in front of us. And so, needless to say, I was not a very good crash test dummy, and I spent a good portion of at least the first half of last year in what I would chronic misery, where life just was pretty bleak. Since then, of course, you know, I've gotten better, but it gives me a greater understanding of chronic pain and also mental state after an accident. What happened was, shortly after my accident, a very nice young man showed up to my door to look at my car, even though my insurance company had already totaled it, and my husband was out working, and I was pretty miserable. It was the week after my accident. I had just had a CAT scan done with my physician. She was concerned and pretty certain I had a concussion. I had a 24/7 headache, and I felt like I had the flu. Getting out of bed was pretty difficult, and things were just miserable, to say the least. And he comes, and I'm explaining to him that I'm happy to testify on his insured's behalf. I didn't feel that it was insured's fault. A lady had stopped on the freeway with her turn signal on to get in the merge lane because she had missed the exit. And so it was kind of a... So basically I offered him tea, everything's great, and I said, look, I would rather not have my car totaled because I cannot deal with anything right now. If there's any way to fix it, we'll even pay the difference. I just can't deal with anything. I've got a farm, I've got kids, a huge yard, a huge orchard. And he goes, well, Mrs. Minton, we'd like to help you out. We know that it's an inconvenience. I can offer you $500. To help you, you know, to hire somebody to come in and help you on your farm. And I thought, oh, yeah, right, like, you know. And I said, no, that's okay. I mean, who would I hire? And, well, we could, you know, you could use that money to buy prescription medications until you're reimbursed into your PIP. No, that's okay. You know, I've got health insurance. Well, Mrs. Minton, you can use that $500 for anything you'd like. And I'm thinking, boy, Progressive sure has nice adjusters. I really, really, what a nice guy. And I said, no, I mean, it's really not that big of a deal. It wasn't financial. It was physical at that point. And he said, well, you know, we could make it $750, and it would release, very quietly, he said, and it would release my client of any further liability. And I had been an insurance agent. I understood what he was saying. I mean, the light finally came on. I mean, it took me a minute. And I said, excuse me, can you repeat yourself? And he did. And I said, that's illegal. And he said, no, it's not. And I said, well, it certainly is immoral. And I chewed his butt pretty good. Had my husband come in, had him repeat it. And then basically I said, so what happens if I sign? And he said, well, your health insurance company is responsible for your future medical expense. So here I just told him that I got back and had a CAT scan, that I had a 24/7 headache that my doctor advised that I would probably have for the next month. I had all kinds of problems, you know, I have a knee problem, a neck problem, a shoulder problem, and, you know, a life problem. You know, it's just very heavy and hard to deal with. And here he is trying to take advantage of me when I'm most vulnerable. So, and he's willing to pass the buck to my health insurance company. So I didn't believe him. I honestly did not believe him. So I contacted the insurance commissioner's office, and they said, you know, it is legal. And then I contacted my health insurance company, and they said, yeah, we're not happy about getting this dumped on us, but it's pretty frequent. They like to, you know, slip it to us. And then I got online and realized that this is a predatory quitclaim settlement, and they do this. Their goal is to get out within 72 hours and get you to sign off quick before you realize your injuries. And I approached Senator Metzger because minorities, younger people, older people are getting taken advantage of, and it's unconscionable that there isn't already a law on the books preventing this type of thing. So please give it your full support, and it really would mean a lot to me, and I'm sure a lot of other people. You don't have to ask too many people that have been affected by this type of thing. You know, it's amazing. You probably know people yourself that have been kind of swooned down the road. And it was so manipulative. And, you know, what more do you say other than, I have a concussion. You know, you shouldn't be here, you know, even offering. You know more than I do with the type of accident that I had, what type of injuries I would have. How dare you come to my home and try to sell me down the river? So thus, this bill. Thank you very, very much.
Ms. Minton, thank you very much for sharing your personal story with us. We appreciate that. Are there questions of the committee? Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else signed up to testify, Jim, on this bill? There's no other witnesses signed up. We will close the public hearing, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2369. We have the Dash A5 amendments in front of us.
Do you want a motion?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2369.
Senator George has moved the Dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2369. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2369A as amended by the committee to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2369A as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Senator Metzger, we're moving the bill as amended to the Senate floor. No objection. The motion carries. Senator Metzger, I assume you would like to carry
okay.
the bill?
Okay. Happy to do so.
Okay. So... And now we're going to get back to the top.
Yeah.
Okay. So we will now go back to the top of the calendar, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3128. Jim, if you want to talk about the bill, Senator Metzger is going to be heading out here
in about 20 minutes or so. So Senator Starr will run the meeting, and I'll be with you as long as I can.
All right. We have one person to testify. Gary Conklin, and then Jim, would you like to explain the
yes,
bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3128 authorizes the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to waive the corporate surety bond required for grower sales privilege or warehouse licensee when the licensee does not expect to be liable for payment of a privileged tax.
Thank you, Jim. Mr. Conklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gary Conklin, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. House Bill 3128 is basically sort of an extension of legislation that was enacted in the 2007 session dealing with wineries. What this does is provide the same agency discretion to waive a surety bond requirement for grower sales privilege licensees and wine warehouse licensees. It also provides that these same waivers would be available to similarly situated out-of-state licensees. As you know, under the Granholm Supreme Court ruling, we need to have equality in privileges both for in-state and out-of-state wineries. So this bill is has really no opposition, no controversy. It's pretty much a technical fix. I know you've heard that before. The check is in the mail, but in this case, it's a pretty accurate description. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Is there questions, Mr. Conklin? Senator George, you don't want to amend this? Yeah.
I was noticing, Mr. Chair, that the relating clause was very narrow. This year.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, some of us learned. But I love you still.
Any questions for Mr. Conklin? If not, we will. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on this particular bill?
Thank you.
Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3128. We're open to work session, House Bill 3128.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3128 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger has moved House Bill 3128 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Seeing none, motion carries. Who'd like to carry this bill? I'll carry the bill. All right, moving on. We will move to House Bill 3462. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3462. Jim, would you like to give us a brief?
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3462 authorizes the Department of Consumer Business Services Building Codes Division to establish a program to train, qualify, and certify specialized building inspectors to enforce portions of the specialty code. We were going to send for Representative Gilman on this, and I apologize if we didn't do that. We have no amendments on this. It establishes a sunset date of January 2nd, 2016, and it establishes a certificate expiration no later than 2 years after that.
Great. Okay. If I could have Pat Allen and Brian Krieg up to testify first. Is Brian in the room? Yes. And then we'll have LOC and AOC testify together. So please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Patrick Allen. I'm the acting administrator of the Building Codes Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I think AOC and LSC were planning to give you a little bit of the setup of why we're here and what the bill does. I can dive right into the content of the bill if you like, and then they can kind of loop back and give you the why we're here. The bill effectively does three things. It creates a flexible training certification and education pilot project that allows us to deal with an issue, particularly, although not exclusively, in rural Oregon, of a current requirement that inspectors need to be certified to a level uniformly that's quite a bit higher than the work itself often requires. Today, if you're adding restroom facilities at a small restaurant, you've got to basically have an inspector who's capable to inspect hospitals and high-rise buildings and those kinds of things that typically don't get built or not very often in those kinds of communities. This allows us to do some targeted certification and training to better match the skill level and the requirements for those inspectors to the workload that they more commonly see at different levels in different kinds of jurisdictions. Secondly, it allows us to make some flexible use of a variety of funding sources to deal with that training program, including the existing surcharge on building permits, existing training resources that are in the system. Finally, it increases accountability for inspectors by allowing us to have authority to suspend, revoke, condition, or in other way modify the certification of inspectors. It also sets up a renewal for inspectors' certifications. Right now, it's a one-time $22 lifetime deal. You get certified initially, and that certification then lasts until revoked for a fairly narrow set of reasons. This allows us to establish a renewal process, potentially a renewal fee as well, and then we would use that process to help work with this pilot project, and as you heard, it does sunset in 2016.
Very good. Mr. Craig?
Chair Metzger, Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, Brian Creek for the record. I am here representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association and the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association. We are in support of this measure. As Patrick has laid out a number of the key points on it, we're in agreement with those. I think that in the long term, there's going to be some better things with consistency, training, and the accountability. It really puts a similar scenario for the inspectors to what licensed trades have to go through, and it should speed up some of the inspections out in some of the more rural areas. The fact that it has a sunset clause, so this is a little bit of an experiment, that's one of the things that makes us comfortable with this change from the current situation on here. We have a chance to look at it, and if we've overdone it, we can retract.
Great. Are there questions for either one of these two witnesses on this bill? No questions. Thank you very much. Arch Lock and Daniel Eisenbeis, please. Oh, Representative Gilman, please. Front and center.
Mr. Chair, representing George Gilman, 55. This is a priority bill. In rural areas, inspectors should be able to look at more than one thing, maybe electrical and plumbing. We don't want that for urban areas. There's adequate inspectors close by to do inspections. But in the rural areas, I give Lake U as an example, most of the inspectors have to come from Bend. And so you have to have one for plumbing, one for et cetera, et cetera. It's a very important bill. I hope you'll pass it. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Representative.
I don't know if I can hear them.
Thank you very much, Representative. Appreciate you being here. Okay, now we'll have Art Schlock and Daniel Eisenbeis, Associate Owner of Counties, League of Oregon Cities. Art, do you want to proceed first here? I guess I went backwards compared to, as it relates to your preordained.
It's quite all right.
Order, but please.
Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. Representative Gilman, I think, basically teed up why we're here. There is a problem that we're trying to address with this opportunity for additional education and training for inspectors that are, I would be characterized again, in rural Oregon. But in talking to a number of areas that even in, let's say, Clackamas County, in the more remote areas of the county, when you have to have multiple inspectors come out, it takes maybe 2 or 3 days in order to get the inspection so that somebody can continue to work on a project that they have, even though the project may be relatively small at this point. But as we know, time is costly. And we also are in a situation where it is important to get development going in an expeditious time because jobs are important at this point. So this is, I think, a very good, positive step forward to provide additional training for inspectors so that they can do a little bit more in the way of plumbing and electrical than what they currently, let's say, what a residential inspector can do today. And so that's the thrust, and I would urge you to support the bill as it's come from the House, the A.N. Grost 3462, and move it to the floor with your blessing.
Thank you, Mr. Slack. Mr. Eisenbeiss.
Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the League of Oregon Cities. Briefly, we believe that this bill will help add some flexibility to the building inspector training and certification program while maintaining the integrity of these programs, which will end up providing better service to our customers and help move forward toward a future where, with retiring baby boomers, we may see even more need for this in areas that are not necessarily rural in nature, where the need seems to be greatest right now. Thank you, and I'd welcome any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Either one? Any questions? No questions. Anyone else in the audience wish to testify on House Bill 3462? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3462. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3462.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3462 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger has moved House Bill 3462 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Who'd like to carry the bill? Senator George?
Yep.
Great. We will move next to House Bill 2955. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2955.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2955 authorizes contract agency to accept general obligation bonds and irrevocable letters of credit as financial security from a contractor in lieu of monies held as retainage. In connection with public improvement contracts, it permits contractors to accept similar instruments from subcontractors. You have the dash A4 amendment, which requires contracting agency to accept alternative forms of credit financial security unless the agency makes findings that the alternative security offered poses extraordinary risk.
Very good. Thank you. I need to have Mr. Wildish and Mr. Rockowitz. Please, welcome. Okay. Thank you for coming here.
Thank you. Chair Metzger, Vice Chair Starr, committee, good afternoon. My name is Stephen Wildish. I reside in Eugene, Oregon. I'm here today representing my company, Wildish Construction Company, and Oregon AGC. We seek your support of House Bill number 2955 as amended. House Bill 2955 A4 is designed to put back in place something that was lost. The 2003 Legislative Assembly revamped and updated the Public Contracting Rules, ORS 279. A significant amount of housekeeping was included in this process, including removing redundant language. As part of this housekeeping, a regulation dealing with alternatives to cash retainage was repealed. By all accounts, the effect of repealing the regulation was not contemplated and was part of this housekeeping effort, given that some of the substantive parts of the regulation were already covered in the ORS 279 and were in fact redundant. This situation is not unlike cleaning your garage. All kinds of things get rearranged and thrown out, only to find out later that something unintended was disposed of. House Bill 2955A4 will once again allow contractors to use irrevocable letters of credit as an alternative to cash retainage. Our company has a long history of posting irrevocable letters of credit in lieu of cash retainage on all our public contracts, counties, cities, ODOTs, and many others. This instrument is secure and easily accessible by a public owner, and its use will help ease cash flow constraints, which can be critically important to a contractor given these difficult economic times. We ask you to support House Bill 2955 in its amended form because House Bill 2555A4 more closely reflects the prior law. The previous law provided that certain enumerated alternatives to cash retainage may be selected at the option of the contractor. House Bill 2955 without amendment provides that a public owner may or may not allow a contractor to use these instruments. House Bill 2955 as amended provides that unless the instrument poses an extraordinary risk to the contracting agency, the contractor may once again, at its option, provide the alternatives to cash retainage listed in House Bill 2955. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Just for reference for the committee, I'm speaking to the A4-A4 amendments. Mr. Rakowitz.
Yes. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Rakowitz with AGC. I just wanted to add a couple of procedural matters around. First, I would point out that the bill did pass in its A and gross form, 59 with one excused in the House. Pretty close to unanimous. And I would also add that the only reason that the -4A4 amendment has come forward today as opposed in the House is because of in the last deadline when bills had to move out of committee, there simply wasn't time to make the change. And finally, I would add that I have been in communication last week and then confirmed again yesterday that the specific language in -A4 has been worked out in a cooperative manner with ODOT, Doug Tindall in particular. I confirmed that again yesterday, so I believe we are in very good shape. I don't know that anybody here from here from ODOT today, but I do know they have an OTC commission that might be what's keeping folks busy in another area. And I thought I was going to say until just a few minutes ago, I learned that AOC may have issues. I thought I was going to say this was a bill without any opposition. So if there's an opportunity and it makes any sense, probably preferably Steve, if there are issues come up, we might ask that we get a chance to speak to those issues.
Very good. Thank you. Are there questions now for these two witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much. So let's go ahead and have Gene Dernan and Brian Krieg. We'll have the contractors come up, and then we'll have AOC come up at the end.
First. Good afternoon, Chair Metzger, Vice Chair Starr, and members of the committee. My name is Gene Dernan, and I'm here on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association. I'm also the Vice President and Operations Manager for Salem Fire Alarm. I encourage you to pass House Bill 2955 in its amended form because it would correct an unintended consequence of the 2003 legislature's revision of contracting rules, which resulted in the loss of several options of retainage. House Bill 2955 would allow contracting agencies to accept items of value other than bonds pledged in lieu of retainage from contractors performing public improvement projects. This would include cash, securities, and letters of credit. Additionally, House Bill 2955 would allow contractors to accept similar items of value from subcontractors. Providing improved access to retained funds improves the ability of contractors and subcontractors to make best use of their working capital. To fund the cost of retained money, contractors pass the cost on to agencies, increasing the cost of
public construction. Pledging assets in lieu of retainage would give contractors a competitive edge, resulting in lower costs of construction for the public agency. Additionally, House Bill 2955 does not increase the risk to public agencies or the state, as the assets pledged by the contractor are available to assure completion of the contract work. House Bill 2955 does not increase the cost of public improvement projects and could result in cost savings. During difficult economic times, contractors need to optimize the use of their working capital to fund employment, equipment, etc. This is especially true of Oregon's small businesses. Both sides of labor and management support this bill. Shops that have collective bargaining agreements and open shops support this bill. I encourage you to send House Bill 2955 in its amended form to the Senate floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Krieg.
Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Krieg here today representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. We also support this bill. This will be a help for small businesses. Let's put it simple on that. With a net profit of 2 to 3%, when you have retainage, they could be up around 10%. The dollar flow and being paid slowly on that, it can break a company. So we urge your support of this bill. It'll be a big help. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Other questions for either one of these witnesses?
Seeing none, thank you very much. Mike Eliason, Associated Oregon Counties.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. We support the bill in its original form that passed the House, and we don't necessarily oppose the bill, the A4 amendment. But our county road program manager just wanted to bring to my attention that he was potentially a little bit concerned with taking the may out and making it shall, except for in extraordinary circumstances. And we just now saw these and wanted to check with some county councils just to make sure that this wasn't going to provide going down a road they didn't want to go. So that's basically all that we are doing, is we just saw this and we're a little bit concerned about changing the may to a shall. And so we wanted to take a look at this for a little bit longer.
Are there questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Okay, anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2955A? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2955A and open a work session on House Bill 2955A.
Mr. Chair, I move the -A4 amendment to House Bill 2955.
Senator Metzger has moved the -A4 amendment to House Bill 2955. Is there discussion? Only thing I would add, I appreciate the county's position. I feel confident in that we have the department saying it's okay. The legislature will be around if this ultimately becomes a problem. We can address it again in future sessions. So, any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2955 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger has moved House Bill 2955 as amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none. So ordered. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2955, and I'll carry this bill. Moving on, we will work House Bill 2457. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2457. Jim?
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2457 allows journeyman plumber licensee to design the plumbing portion of a fire sprinkler system for installation either a residential structure subject to the low-rise residential dwelling code or any of appurtenance to a residential structure of any type. You have the -A3 amendment that clarifies that journeyman plumbers need to possess no additional authority to engage in fire sprinkler system plumbing design work. And just before the meeting here, we did receive the fiscal and revenue on -A3. No fiscal, no revenue.
Thank you. Well, let's see here. We've got folks that are signed up on both sides of this bill, which is interesting, seeing as though we haven't had that really this afternoon so far. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call the folks that are the proponents first.
And then we'll have the opponents come and speak. So that would be Ron Murray, Genoa, and Brian Krieg.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Ron Murray. I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters of the United States and Canada, Local 290, as well as the American Society of Sanitary Engineering. And we are asking you to support the Dash 3 amendments as we feel that they have answered the concerns of the opposition that we heard in the House, and primarily those of the engineering community. Mr. Koba can't be here at this particular time, but he also endorses the Dash 3 amendments on behalf of the engineering community. As you may be aware, the state of Oregon is the leader in the nation in the installation of residential fire sprinkler systems, and we've proven time and time again that we install the most cost-effective, most efficient fire sprinkler systems in the United States, and we do that through the use of licensed journeyman plumbers. And I'd like to just clarify on this bill, this deals with one and two family dwellings. This is housing only, and it only affects licensed journeyman plumbers. The standard that the state of Oregon has adopted for the installation of these systems is NFPA 13D, the National Fire Protection Association standard. And that standard that has been adopted by the state of Oregon is a consensus standard. And so the consensus group includes sprinkler fitters, plumbers, building officials, contractors, and so forth and so on. 2457 supports the current business model that we have in the state of Oregon. This is the way we install and design residential fire sprinkler systems in the state of Oregon, and it is what makes these systems so cost effective. There is only one training model in the United States that's approved by the American National Standards Institute, and that's ASSE 7000, and that's what we train to here in the state of Oregon for licensed journeyman plumbers. The ANSI standard is a consensus standard. It's agreed to. I chaired the committee, as it so happens, and it is comprised of sprinkler fitters, plumbers, and engineers. That is the national standard. If the state decides that certification for the design of these systems for homes is necessary, we certainly would be amenable to that next session. But as it stands today, we would like to clear up the law and just verify the current business model. If I can answer any questions or perhaps at the end of the testimony.
Very good. Well, we'll hear the three of you testify, and then we'll open up for questions. Genoa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. Genoa Ingram, representing the Oregon Fire Service and particularly the Joint Fire Legislative Committee. The Joint Fire Legislative Committee is made up of the Fire Chiefs Association, the Fire District Directors Association, the volunteer firefighters, and others across the state. And they looked at the bill about a month ago and voted unanimously to support the bill. They did not look at the technical issues. They just believe philosophically that this bill will move forward this important life safety mechanism. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Krieg.
Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, Brian Krieg here today representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. Our contractors utilize the services of the UA 290 plumbers and other of the UA units across the state. The nature of this type of work at the residential level is not as complex and technically complex as that needed for commercial level. We're very confident that this is a great bill, that our people can do the work on this, that it'll be a cost-effective way that the consumers can put in these types of home safe systems. And if they put them in, that'll make for a safer community.
Real quickly, Brian, do you represent one of the plumbers' unions?
The Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association.
But not the union.
But not the union. Ron is our counterpart on that for our labor force.
So it's interesting. It looks like I've got someone that's going to testify up next that represents labor as well on the other side of this bill. Any comment on that?
I do. We are somewhat surprised by this. This is the first we've heard of opposition to this bill. There certainly wasn't any testimony from the sprinkler fitters in the House side, as well as, I said, the consensus standards that the state has adopted is a consensus standard developed by the sprinkler fitters and the plumbers. So we don't think the legislature is the place to have a union turf war, but that's what this has become, I think.
Sure, we'd appreciate it if we weren't. So, any further questions of these witnesses? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is a public hearing, so we're going to hear all sides of an issue. This is great. We'll have Brian Dunn and Michael Hardy. Brian Dunn and Michael Hardy, please. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Sure. Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, my name is Brian Dunn. I am a representative for United Association of Sprinkler Fitters Local Union 669. I represent some 450 fire sprinkler installers through the state of Oregon, and I stand before you today to oppose this bill on a couple of issues. One is that there is currently in place already a national standard for designers to design fire sprinkler systems. That standard lies with the National Institute for Certification and Engineering Technologies, also known as NICET. There's a competency level test involved in that, and virtually all of our contractors utilize that certification to ensure that the designers are competent in designing fire sprinkler systems. What this bill doesn't address is that journeyman level plumbers in the state of Oregon have virtually little to no training in designing fire sprinkler systems. While this may spur a level of installation across the state, which would be a positive, it doesn't address the competency level of design, and that would be our concern with this bill. That's pretty much all I guess I have. That.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hardy.
For the record, my name is Michael Hardy. I have provided written testimony. I would like to clarify a few things that have been said. The engineering community in Oregon does not support this bill. The Professional Engineers of Oregon, representing 14,000 licensed engineers, opposes the bill and has filed a letter such. I'm a mechanical engineer licensed in Oregon. As such, I frequently design sprinkler systems, primarily in commercial and institutional buildings. I'd like to bring to the attention that the residential sprinklers we're talking about are a hybrid system. The sprinklers are very integrated with the plumbing side of things. The House bill only addresses design issues, does not get into turf wars as to who installs these systems. The design of these are really, again, they're integrated, and the bill expands the current exemptions for plumbers into buildings like condominiums, row housing, things like that, where you already have requirements for engineered plans for structure, for architecture, for mechanical, for other areas. There's no reason that we need this bill to begin with. I'd also like to mention that this isn't really an economic issue, because we already have certified professionals in Oregon providing these services, and we'd be, if we're shifting jobs anywhere, we'd be taking away from other Oregonians. And that's essentially all I have at this point.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for either one of these? I have just one. In the House, did either one of you testify in opposition to the bill, or were there other of your members perhaps that testified in opposition to the bill?
I did not, and the professional engineers did not, because the original House bill, as we saw it, only took the existing exemptions and added requirements for certification and training. And in that regard, I did not oppose that. The amendments that were put forward and then came out of the committees, et cetera, is really where the objection comes in, and they remove all safeguards, all legal, all commercial liability, et cetera. They're just, and so our problems really came up with the amendments.
No, we did not. I was unaware of this bill at the House level.
Great, thank you. Representative Senator Starr,
I would just comment that the letters of opposition to me have been written in the last few days. So.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you very both for your testimony. I appreciate it. Sue Laszlo and Mari Lopez.
Things going on. Good afternoon, Chair and member of the committee. My name for the record is Sue Laszlo, and I am the sitting board president of Oregon State Board of Engineering Examiners and Land Surveyors, also known as OSBEALS. We are in opposition of this bill. The OSBEALS mission is to regulate the practices of engineering and land surveying in the state as they relate to the welfare of the public and safeguarding the health, life, and property. Our concern is that the bill, as written, does not protect the public. What it does is it offers the journeyman plumber to take on additional design responsibility and offer it to the public without the benefit of additional education, certification, or regulation. As engineers and land surveyors of this board, we believe the professional licensure demonstrates the professional competency that the board expects when they are procure these service, when the public expects, as engineers and land surveyors of this board, we believe the professional licensure demonstrates the professional competencies that the public expects when they procure these services. There's already an exception in place that allows plumbers to do work. This particular bill expands that exception, and we're concerned about that. Allowing the journeyman plumber to design will essentially be performing much of the work that an engineer already does and without the proper accreditation. So we ask that you consider not passing this bill, as we believe it does not protect the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Mari. Ms. Lopez.
Good afternoon. I'm Mari Lopez, the Executive Secretary for OSBEALS. You know, this bill has crept up in many other legislative sessions without successfully passing. And recently, the board requested an Assistant Attorney General opinion on whether the design of fire protection systems should be designed by a professional engineer and an architect. And that opinion came back to the board as yes, the design of fire protection systems is the practice of engineering and the practice of architect. And since that opinion came out, we've seen a lot of movement coming from the contractor side in trying to change what has already been established. I just want to add that that I'm here today to answer any additional questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Question, yeah, sure. Senator George?
Yeah, could you give me a copy of that that opinion that was...
Yes, okay. We'll be sure to get that to you.
Did you just submit it to the committee?
I haven't yet, but I will.
Oh, if you could, that'd be great. And then we'd all get a copy of it.
Okay, thank
you very much.
Great. Are there any other questions? Senator Schrader?
I just want to clarify something here, because my understanding when you're actually doing a building, I mean, the architect and the engineering is already in the design of the structure. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, if the design is already there and you have folks with expertise installing pieces, I guess I'm not understanding exactly where the objections are coming from. For the engineering community and the architecture community, because it's a design, and at least I'm hearing is that the plumbing folks just want to already install what's already in design. Can you clarify that? Is that
I'd be happy to. The bill right now says the journeyman plumber may design the plumbing portion.
Okay, so there is
that confusion as to them allowing them to actually decide what the size of the pipe is, how it's going to hang from the structure, all of these things that we have to consider that could possibly affect the safety of the public.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? No further questions. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I think that Mr. Murray, do you have anything to add or to respond? Real quickly, since we're in public hearing.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, thank you for having me back up again. I think we're kind of going down the wrong path here. This bill has a very, very, very narrow focus. First of all, in the state of Oregon, a licensed journeyman plumber has the authority to install a residential fire sprinkler system, design the system, let me be very clear, design the system on any structure under 4,000 square feet. The objection and the purpose of 2457 is simply to remove the obstruction at 4,000 square feet. There's no difference between a building that's 3,999 square feet and one that's 4,000 square feet. As Senator Schrader pointed out, the structure is already engineered. We're talking about a plumbing system. In the state of Oregon, current statute allows a licensed journeyman plumber that's been certified by the Building Code Division to design a residential fire sprinkler system that is plumbing based. That is current statute. This doesn't change that. We're simply removing the encumbrance of the square footage. And here again, the intent of this legislation is for a one and two family dwelling. And that's the legislative concept that we developed. So when we talk about public safety and life safety, I am going to reiterate, the only American National Standard Institute approved residential fire sprinkler design curriculum is ASSC 7000. That is for plumbing-based fire suppression systems. In the body of the bill, you will also see that the intent of this bill is for one and two family structures. So we're kind of going down, we're getting off the path here. This is a very, very, very narrow scope of the bill. We almost considered it editorial in nature, and what we've developed now is a turf war.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, Senator Schrader, your question.
And just let me ask one follow-up. Thank you, Chair Starr. So essentially, the journeyman plumbers are already doing these installations, and there has been no significant decrease in public safety because of that. Is that what I'm hearing? That essentially they're doing the job. These systems are safe. The public has not been endangered. And indeed, there's a level of expertise that the journeyman plumbers have in order to do this adequately.
Chair Starr, Senator Schrader, that's absolutely correct. Oregon is the leader in residential fire sprinklers because of the coalition that the plumbers have entered into with the Oregon Fire Service, period. And like I said, some of the opposition we're hearing today, we've never heard it before. And so we're a little surprised.
Senator Schrader.
I wonder if you would address the liability issue. That is some of the opposition that I've heard. That you have the authority to design in these low-rise residential areas of a certain size, but you also can walk away without any liability. Is that true or false?
Senator Chair, Senator Verger, that's absolutely completely false. A plumbing contractor is one of the most highly regulated contractors in the state of Oregon. A plumber is licensed under the Building Code Division, and he is always liable to have his license revoked by the Building Code Division. The plumbing contractor is licensed by the Building Code Division and the CCB. So the amount of liability that the plumbing contractor undertakes is as great as any contractor in the state of Oregon. And if anyone says differently, they are certainly misinformed.
Follow up?
Well, I have more than one saying so you've got several that are misinformed.
Senator George.
Thank you. I've advocated that the plumbers have more latitude, as you know, earlier in the session. And then when the backflow device situation came up, then the plumbers argued against expanding other people's fields. And I don't mind competition in this, but I'm trying to figure out what the philosophical consistency is of the plumbers. And to me, this is what's hard is that I'm more than willing to step down the path of giving you guys more latitude, but there, it sort of has to be tit for tat. If this is all going to be turf wars about people protecting themselves in a tough economy, then everybody's got to be able to be flexible, especially with those professionals who have the qualifications to do the job. We can't just be getting into turf wars, and it has to be consistent, and you're asking me to, mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? So,
and I can answer that.
Okay.
Chair Starr, Senator George. Thank you for bringing up the backflow question. We'd almost evaded that for 5 months. Our concept is simple. A plumber that completes an apprenticeship through the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters completes a five-year apprenticeship. It covers everything from backflow prevention to residential fire sprinklers, plumbing-based residential fire sprinkler systems. Our message is consistent, and that's public safety. We are going to contend that there is nobody in the state of Oregon that protects the public safety of the individual in the residential domain as well as a licensed journeyman plumber, and we will stand by that. We don't believe that untrained people, and we know that the story that you've heard about backflow, and it's not true. And if you come to our training center, we have 11 training centers in the state of Oregon. Our training center in Tualatin is 97,000 square feet. Our training budget is larger than most fire departments is. So we stand by our training, and our message is consistent. A residential fire sprinklers installed by a plumber are installed by a licensed journeyman plumber under a plumbing permit with a plumbing inspector. They're our most highly regulated system installed in an abode. And that's what we are trying to prove, is that that is the current model in Oregon, and it works.
Mr. Chair, follow up. I guess you follow your logic through, though. And what the engineers are arguing is that they've gone through another set of design criteria to protect, and their education is designed to protect in the engineering field. And if you apply your logic, then I would vote no on this bill, meaning the same exact logic you use on what I don't think it takes as much training on the backflow devices that right. You guys are doing with those inspectors for repairs. If I apply your same logic to that, then I would reject this bill. And I guess what I'm saying to you is that the engineers are arguing that it takes additional education that you guys don't have. If you want to go to engineering school and a plumber school, I'm sure that they would be no problem with you guys doing that. I happen to believe that you shouldn't eliminate competition through regulation. I think that both should be allowed. But you see my problem with voting for this and then watching you guys block the backflow guys from repairing backflow devices. I don't get it.
It's, Senator Starr, Senator George, like I said, the scope of this bill is very, very narrow. The plumber in the state of Oregon has been authorized by you, the legislature, to design plumbing-based residential fire sprinkler systems, and they have been allowed to do so for eons, decades. As you heard today in the testimony, only recently, and I'm going to tell you where this started, there was, in the last legislative session, there was an argument between the electrical board over jurisdiction with the engineering board. And we believe that that turf war has carried over into this. And so the engineering board, which I haven't told you, went to the AG and got an opinion. And now they're saying that on structures over 4,000 square feet, and keep in mind it's structures over 4,000 square feet, they have jurisdiction. So this is new. This is something that's come up since the legislature met last time. That's why you're dealing with it today.
Mr. Murray, that's good. That's good because we're going to close the public hearing. We've got another bill to move.
Thank you.
Not to move, but to hear. And I just saw a hand raised. Someone else wishes to testify. This is probably your only chance, so please come forward. I wanted to close the public hearing, but please come forward, and you can provide brief testimony. We need to move. We've got another bill with
I'll
a long
quick,
list.
I'll be quick. Thank you.
We're not going to move this bill today, by the way.
My name is Kathleen Roach. I am a certified fire protection specialist. I am the fire life safety team leader at Interface Engineering, Mechanical and Electrical and Fire Protection Consulting Engineers in Portland, and also California and Washington and other places. And I am first vice president for the Society of Fire Protection Engineers Cascade Chapter in Portland. And I would like to voice some concerns that I had that the way this House Bill 2457 is currently written, it's allows plumbers, we really don't have an objection to plumbers designing and installing NFPA 13D systems, which are for one and two family dwellings. Because those systems only you have to have listed devices listed sprinklers, and they have to be according to, located according to certain rules. But as far as hanging and bracing or other aspects of the installation of these systems, they are allowed by the NFPA 13D to be installed by plumbers, according to their codes. But the way this is written, the low-rise residential dwelling code also would allow detached congregate residences up to and including 10 persons or less, up to 3 stories above grade, and that doesn't fall within NFPA 13D. That falls within NFPA 13R, which then has to be have a much more complex installation, hanging and bracing. So, but they're not required to have any show any expertise in this beforehand. So, we don't feel that the welfare of the citizens of Oregon will be well served by allowing the plumbers such broad latitude.
Very good. Thank you for getting that on the record. Appreciate that. We need to move on. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2457. The proponents of the bill, you just get some unease among members of the committee you're going to have to deal with before we move the bill. Do I need to this bill will be carried over to Wednesday, May 27th. For the record, this bill will be carried over for Wednesday, May 27th. Takes care of that issue. Now, we have another bill, and we've got a half an hour or so, and a lot of folks signed up to testify. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3039. And Representative Reed is lead off. Jim, can you just real quickly give us a...
House Bill 3039, Mr. Chairman, directs the Public Utility Commission to establish pilot programs for each electric company to demonstrate the uses and effectiveness of electrical energy delivered through solar voltaic energy systems. This is the solar energy bill.
Thank you, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27 in Beaverton. When I was deciding what to wear today, I thought I'd try to be optimistic and pick a bright tie, and it seems to have worked. We have a sunny day, and it's nice to be talking about an exciting opportunity on a day like this. What I want to do is just try to underscore quickly why I think this bill is important and some of the approach it takes, as well as a little bit of the history, and I'll leave it to the others who are here to speak eloquently about the real specifics. But I think it's no surprise to people here that jobs and the economy are top of mind for all of us, but in the midst of those challenging times, there are some real opportunities, and I think this is consistent with that. One of our great opportunities, I think, as we deal with the challenging economy, is to transform our economy into ways that are based on clean energy and in ways that expand the economy, expand opportunities, and support the environment all at the same time. There were 3 bills related to solar energy that came to the committee I have the honor of chairing on the House side. And this is I think, represents the culmination of those efforts. And I want to give a lot of credit to the people who participated in numerous work groups, particularly my staff who coordinated that process. I think the approach that underscores all of this bill is the some for all and all for none. There were a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different philosophies that entered into this discussion, and I think what we have before us now is a good, moderate approach that will test the various mechanisms that have been advocated and allow the legislature and the PUC to supervise that and decide how to extend or change those programs as we are able to see what works and what doesn't. There are basically 2 components, a feed-in tariff that is aimed at smaller systems and has a 75% target for residential, so 75% of that component would be aimed at residential systems, and a larger scale component that would allow big-scale solar installations to be tested. All of these come with sideboards, with caps, and with sunsets. It is a relatively small amount in total, about 45 megawatts, which is very small as it relates to the total power in the state. And I think it's a good way for us to take an innovative step forward that's very consistent with our traditions in Oregon of being innovative and collaborative. And I think it represents the sort of thing we should be doing in the legislature in helping the state become and continue to become a real leader as it relates to the development of solar energy. We've seen already good benefits as Oregon has taken that approach, and I hope we can continue. So with that, I will encourage the committee's support and sit ready to do my best to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Desiree. Commissioner Schrader.
Good afternoon, Chair Starr and members of the committee. My name is Desiree Strayer. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. And I want to take the opportunity first to thank Chair Metzger for his incredible leadership yesterday on bringing all the stakeholders together and listening out from all sides what some of the current issues with the legislation that came over from the House 3039. We'd also like to recognize all the incredible good work that Representative Reed and his staff did in the House, where HB 3039 passed 47-11, and under the refined bill that this committee will shape, Oregon will become and continue a greater force in the emerging green economy. Members of the Oregon Solar Energy Industry Association would like to express our support for HB 3039. We feel HB 3039 is an elegant way to promote solar renewable energy in Oregon without increasing and incurring costs to our state's strained budget. First, I'd like to give you a little background of where this bill came from. Secondly, the compromises that were made in the House. Thirdly, address the amendments that are before you, the dash fives, and soon to be, I think, where they're going to be the dash tens. Just overall where we've left this as well. Originally, this bill was kind of conceived out of the governor's renewable energy working group back in September. It came to the industry's top of mind that we needed to put some additional tools in the toolbox and at least test them out in a pilot type of demonstration project because of the current economic and state affairs of the state budget, and that there would be some more pressure put on the Betsy. So we felt that it was a responsible move to take a look at all the various tools that would be at our disposal and bring them forth to the legislature to figure out from a public policy standpoint which direction we should go. So the bill that in its original inception, HB 3039, really was a 250-megawatt nameplate. It was a 250-megawatt large utility scale, and it was asking for a 3-to-1 multiplier. When we met with the governor's office, Representative Reed did a very similar thing as Senator Metzger did yesterday. He called all the stakeholders together, and in that, we compromised the bill down to a 20-megawatt nameplate pilot project utility scale, 25-megawatt feed-in tariff pilot project, which also was brought down from a 50-megawatt, and we compromised from a 3-to-1 multiplier down to a 2-to-1 multiplier. We strongly also support and understanding the time constraints of the committee and where you guys sit over the next three hearings with over 17 bills to hear. Instead of having various people come in support of the bill, we've condensed it down to our testimony. And as you can see on the back, as I will address, there are numerous supporters from the bill, including the Oregon University Systems, IBEW, several installers, OSEA Board of Directors and officers, manufacturers, developers, integrators. In addition, we have the City of Salem, City of Gresham, our biomass partner in Polaris, Wave Technology with Ocean Power Technology, the Oregon Economic Community Development Department, and Sanyo, just to list a few others. Lastly, what I'd like to say is that in addition to the compromises, we also took Representative Reed's leadership in that suggesting that we sunset all the incentive programs in 2014, giving the industry as well as the Public Utilities Commission and the legislature an opportunity to reassess the programs, see where we were successful, and identify the possible fixes that we need to continue down the road and give us an opportunity to see if this tool really is going to be an effective tool for the growing industry here. And last but not least, also in our compromise, there was a lot of concern from the installers in the solar industry about Section 4, which you will find in the Dash 10 amendments, has been deleted from the bill. Last but not least, we also support the amendments put forward by the Public Utilities Commission as well as the amendments of Representative Reed's office on HB 3039. In its amended form, this will be a balanced bill to promote jobs, an Oregon solar economy, achieve a diversified renewable portfolio standard, and achieve meaningful carbon reductions. I am submitting a list of our solar energy companies with wholeheartedly support of HB 3039. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are in a time-constrained environment, and I have a long list of folks to testify, so if we can keep our testimony brief.
Chairman Starr.
Understand that it's a broad topic with lots of moving parts, so try to get as broad of an idea of what's in the bill as we can and yet get as much testimony as possible.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, my apologies for interrupting you. My name is Bob Beisner. I'm a vice president at Solar World. We're located in Hillsboro, Oregon. I wanted to speak directly to the multipliers. We feel there are several benefits that accrue with the multipliers. First of all, we're able to diversify the sources of electricity for the state of Oregon. In addition, we're able to go ahead and support the research and development that goes on within the state of Oregon. We also feel that this makes solar more competitive with other electrical resources. It creates an incentive for solar without burdening the state budget. It also replicates programs that are sometimes used in other states, and we have to be aware of the competition that exists with the other states. And it recognizes that all of the utility customers will benefit from solar energy. Lastly, I'd like to reemphasize that the program does sunset in 2014. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one quick question?
Yes, absolutely.
Could I ask you if the list that you said of your proponents, they agree with the amendments? Because you have
the Dash 10.
I have nine amendments in front of me.
Senator Berger, Chair Starr, are you talking about the Dash 10, Senator?
I want to know if the people that have agreed with you have seen the amendments and
correct.
They are all on board with
yes.
the amendments.
Yes.
All right. That's all I need to know.
Very good. Are there other questions? Senator George, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay. I'd like to have Mary Taylor has waited patiently. She wants to come and testify. And then Brent Gunderson and Russ White. Yes. So we'll have City of Salem, City of Gresham, please. Mayor Hughes, former Mayor Hughes.
Mm-hmm. I know him.
We'll just do all the local governments all at once. How's that? Please, Mayor Taylor.
Yes, thank you, Chair Starr and committee. Thank you for having us here today. I am Salem Mayor Janet Taylor. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3039. This bill requires electric companies to develop new demonstration size solar energy production. It has the support of both Portland General Electric and Pacific Power. As you may know, Salem was very fortunate last year to attract the Samuel Solar Company to our Salem Renewable Energy Industrial Park. They're under construction and will be in operation by end of this year, beginning with 200 jobs. To ensure the success of Samuel and the other solar manufacturers that have already located in Oregon, plus those that are actively looking at our state for new facilities, we need to be certain that they are successful by encouraging the market for their products. It does us no long-term benefit if these companies are unable to thrive, and it's really better for them to thrive here in Oregon. In addition, solar use will continue the initiative of reducing our dependence on fossil fuels for electricity. By supporting House Bill 3039, we'll be able to expand our solar energy capacity in Oregon and encourage homeowners and businesses to work with the utilities to create jobs related to the industry in manufacturing, installation, and service jobs. These jobs are in a clean industry that will be sustainable for the long term and provide benefits to all of our communities. The program, as required by House Bill 3039, brings down the cost of renewable energy without burdening the state budget.
It's a program used successfully in other states and provides protection to ratepayers through PUC oversight of associated costs and regular progress reports to you, the legislature. It truly is a win for everyone. I appreciate your time today and the time your positions require to be able to serve. It's not easy when budgets are tight, but your support for House Bill 3039 is a step in the right direction for clean industry and new sustainable jobs. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Chen.
Hello, Vice Chair Starr. Do I have to turn this on? No. Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Janet Young. I'm the Economic Development Director for the City of Gresham. I'm here today representing Mayor Shane Bemis, who unfortunately was not able to be here today, but he has submitted a letter for your perusal showing his strong support for House Bill 3039. Gresham has really been trying to position ourselves as a leader in working toward new clean technologies. We have the right amounts of land, we have good infrastructure, we have good workforce, and really believe that this is an industry that is essential for this state. He has personally been able to see the pivotal role of Oregon's leadership in the solar industry due to the business energy tax credits. He also recognizes, in his letter, uses the pack analogy of being the leader of the pack. This pack has a lot of dogs nipping at its heels. In being at large solar trade shows, including one at Munich just a couple of months ago, it's clear that there are many other states that are working very hard to be in a leadership position in this industry, and that continuing to look at new mechanisms is really critical to staying ahead of that pack. And also, being in Germany allowed him to personally see the role that the feed-in tariff had in really creating and growing the solar industry in Germany and then subsequently in Spain and some other European countries. So we believe this is a very excellent step to keeping Oregon in a leadership position in the solar industry, and we strongly support passage of House Bill 3039.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes.
Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, thank you very much for the time before you today. My name is Tom Hughes. I'm not representing anybody today, but I spent 8 years as the former mayor. I spent 8 years as the mayor of Hillsborough. I'm now the former mayor of Hillsborough, and also am a policy analyst for Tonkin Thorp. In my role as mayor of Hillsborough, I was part of what came to be called Team Oregon, which was an effort on the part of the state OECD to reach out to the solar industry. And in that capacity, I just finished, along with Mayor Bemis, my sixth trade show in solar. And I have had an opportunity to watch how this industry has developed and how it is, and what I think we need to do in order to continue to develop it here in the state of Oregon. We've been very fortunate in Hillsborough to attract the Solar World, which will eventually be a major employer in Hillsborough, and also we think the center of a large solar manufacturing cluster in Hillsborough and also in the Portland metropolitan region. To understand the impact of the feed-in tariff on the solar industry in Oregon, you have only to look to Germany. Germany has less solar access than Oregon does. In fact, on a good day in most of Germany, it's not as good as a bad day in Astoria on the solar access maps. And yet, Germany emerges as the number one solar deployed and the number one solar manufacturing country in the whole world. Part of that, as we are told by our friends at Solar World, has to do with superior German engineering, but we don't believe that that's the entire story. This is an effort on the part of the Germans that started with a policy. It started with a policy that said we don't want to be tied to the pipeline coming through Georgia out of Russia for natural gas and other and other energy things. We want to be as energy independent as we can. And number two, we want to create high-tech jobs within the country. The feed-in tariff has been key to developing the industry in Germany. Make no mistake about it, this industry at this point in time, in most places in the world, Germany included, does not sustain itself on pure economics. It is a policy-driven industry, and it will be for a while. It's already beginning to be profitable or economically feasible in Southern California. We don't care how much is deployed in Southern California. We want those panels manufactured in Oregon because this is where the jobs are going to be. We've already a long ways down that road with the Betsys. We do have a well-trained workforce that as a result of our silicon industry, and we have, to a certain extent, available land, although that's also a diminishing quantity. But we think those of us that have been on the trips believe that we have a 1 to 2 year window of opportunity before the other states catch up with us. And things like feed-in tariff, renewable energy portfolios, and those kinds of policy decisions are going to be key as those policymakers decide where they want to locate those manufacturing jobs. And we want them to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Further questions? Our local government witnesses, thank you very much for coming today. Let's have Russ White, Wright, and Brent Gunderson. Then we'll hear from a slate of folks that are opposed to the bill.
Chairman Metzger, Vice Chair Starr, and members of the committee. I see my truck's parked across the street. I'm proud to get a parking ticket today to address you.
Mayor Kerr is happy about that.
I usually spend my days on roofs installing solar systems, but I'm pleased to be here today to testify before you on House Bill 3039. House Bill 3039 is a jobs bill. There are thousands of trained Oregonians currently out of work looking for elected officials to help them get back to work. This bill will create real in-state sustainable jobs that we desperately need. Our industry projects that at the bottom of the scale, this legislation will create 700 new jobs, and if expanded to its full potential, we could create over 2,000. Oregon's well-trained and capable workforce is ready and waiting for legislators to hit the go button and put them back to work. And I thank you very much for your time on behalf of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association.
Thank you for your testimony. Please.
Chair Metzger, Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Russ Wright, and I'm the Regional Sales Manager for SunEdison here in Oregon. SunEdison is the nation's largest provider of solar energy services. I also serve as a board member for OSEA and past treasurer for the association. I'd like to voice my personal support and that of our company for HB 3039 for several reasons. I think first is the grid benefit that it provides from a distributed generation standpoint while combining the value of the traditional feed-in tariff. Secondly, it helps put solar on a level playing field to help meet the provisions already in the renewable portfolio standard for community energy generation of 8% of that RPS. As Mr. Gunderson mentioned, it does have the potential to create thousands of new jobs in the state. And finally, provide a vehicle that will maintain the sustainable growth of the solar energy industry that's independent of the economic volatility and budgetary constraints that are normally associated with the tax credit-based incentives. Thanks very much for your time and hopefully for your support of this bill.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, I've got a number of folks signed up that are opposed to the bill, and there's one that has traveled for a longer distance, but I'm not sure the first name. Harns, I believe, is the last name. In addition, we have Judy Barnes and Mark Pengilly join. I want to make sure that we get Mr. Harn's testimony in and that he came from greater than 100 miles.
Wow, that's. I would love to see how the email reconstructed my name, but that's great. But thank you.
Go ahead.
My name is Glenn Harris. I'm the CEO of SunCentric Incorporated. We're headquartered in Bend, Oregon. We're an international solar consultancy. Lived and worked in Germany, lived and worked in Australia. Very, very familiar with the solar policies of the world, and we advise our clients about U.S. policy and state policy. So in sum and substance, I appreciated Chair Metzger, the discussion yesterday. I thought it was very clear that there wasn't agreement on this bill, and I took a moment to think through what were the key points that would be impactful to your committee, and I just would like to read my letter into the record, and then hopefully it will frame things up for the others that are behind us. I thought it was very interesting that HB 3039 came to this committee. And I'm, as a many, many year solar participant, I'm not sure that you've been given the right information or really have the experience with solar issues to understand the flaws in this bill. And I hope that you will dialogue with your colleagues in the Environmental and Natural Resources Committee before you take any action on this bill. I think they have experience that would be valuable to the state of Oregon there. I also think that you've been led to believe that this was a very well-negotiated bill, and I'm afraid that you may have been misled in that area. My experience in the solar industry has convinced me that HB 3039 as written will not benefit solar businesses in Oregon. And I also feel that the bill does a disservice to Oregon's entire business community and Oregon citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harris, for your testimony. I apologize on your name. Mr. Pengilly, again, we are scheduled to be out of this room in 5 minutes. We probably will run a little long because we want to get folks in to testify. So if you can, we've got your written testimony. If you can abbreviate, focus on the key issues, that would be fantastic.
Thank you, Vice Chair Starr, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Mark Pengilly. I'm a member of Oregonians for Renewable Energy Payments, which is a group of 400 citizens who strongly support a feed-in tariff for Oregon. Despite our support for the feed-in tariff concept, we feel that this bill in its current form will do more harm than good. HB 3039 is the product of a shotgun wedding in the House, which combined a bill for large-scale electric company solar projects, sections 1 through 7, with a bill for a pilot program to test a feed-in tariff, which is section 8. There are problems with both parts of the bill. Oregon can do better. This bill should receive further scrutiny for its revenue impact and its weaknesses. I would like to direct your attention to three flaws in the bill that I believe merit your attention. Section 6.1e of the bill provides that an electric company can recover its costs for reduced revenues resulting from customer-side qualifying systems. This means that Pacific Corp, for example, would be entitled to receive payment for the revenues it might have earned if its customer generators had not produced electricity, had not produced solar energy. How can it be good policy to require ratepayers to pay the electric company for electricity that it did not produce on top of requiring ratepayers to pay for the electricity actually produced by customer generators? The feed-in tariff part of the bill, Section 8, contains a potential revenue impact of $37.5 million, which may have been overlooked in the House. It also lacks the guarantees needed to attract capital and make the feed-in tariff effective. Section 8, subparagraph 10 of the bill provides for electric companies to claim tax credits for incentive payments made to customer generators that exceed the resource value. The pilot program is 25 megawatts, and payments are to be made for a period of 15 years. Assuming an incentive payment of 20 cents per kilowatt hour, this section could potentially result in a tax credit of $37.5 million, reducing the general fund by that amount. Lastly, Section 8 lacks the essential elements of a feed-in tariff, or FIT. I call it a FITino. It's a feed-in tariff in name only. The genius of a feed-in tariff as a renewable energy incentive is its ability to make small-scale renewable energy production an attractive business undertaking. Private capital seeks predictability and a return on investment. House Bill 3039 fails as a FIT because it does not provide for a reasonable return on investment, and it fails to include a requirement that the electric companies purchase the renewable electricity generated by customer generators. Without these guarantees, capital will not flow to solar projects, and the potential of a feed-in tariff to stimulate economic activity and renewable energy production will not be realized. We can wait 8 months to pass a carefully thought-out renewable energy policy. We can wait 20 months, if needed, to craft and implement an effective bill. But we can't afford to get it wrong and establish a precedent of misguided policy. Spain and California are examples of failed fit policies. House Bill 3039 needs more time and work. Please let it wait until next session, rather than allowing the time pressure of the moment to lead to unintended consequences. The bill needs substantial amendment. We have submitted some -7 amendments, which I recommend for you should you decide to push the bill this time. But our concern is that at this time in the session, there's simply not enough time to do the revenue examination and make this bill correct. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, I just want to recognize the time. If you can just keep your comments as on point and brief and not duplicative of previous testimony, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Judith Barnes. I represent Oregonians for Renewable Energy Payments. Before I begin my own testimony, I should mention that I was requested to drop off testimony that's from Jody Weiser of Tax Fairness Oregon, also in opposition to this bill, and I would ask the committee members to please read that testimony. As many of you may know, Oregonians for Renewable Energy Payments is a citizens group that came together about 5 months ago in support of a pilot feed-in tariff proposed by the governor's climate package. We were very excited about the possibility of having a feed-in tariff here in Oregon, and many of you who've seen us in your offices have seen this chart. We've been singing the praises of feed-in tariffs in Germany and elsewhere. However, we find ourselves at this late date having to oppose this bill, and I regret to say that because we spent a lot of money trying to educate people all over this building about how wonderful a feed-in tariff could be. But House Bill 3039, as proposed, as written, without substantial amendments, will not produce the benefits that we see elsewhere in a feed-in tariff. It also has other problems with it. Citizens in our organization promote and really want to see a strong, viable, stable solar industry in our state. That includes those companies that service small rooftop solar arrays on residences, all the way from small, medium, and commercial to large utility scale projects. 3039, as written, will be harmful to certain sectors of that industry, to the benefit of certain sectors at the expense of other sectors. Please, please do not pass this bill as written, because the unintended consequences of passing bad policy will come back to haunt us for many years. A simple amount of delay, the chance for all of the stakeholders who have an interest in this to get together and really fashion a bill that will help all members of this industry and come back to you with such a bill is really what is needed here. I ask the members please pay attention to the devil is in the details, as we know, with policy, and we would ask you to pay attention to those details and delay, because movement on a flawed policy, no policy is better than bad policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Metzger, I think, has a question.
Just a comment as we leave here for their next panel is, and I appreciate your comments, Mr. Harris, but just kind of for the record, we always do consult with our colleagues on different issues. The reason this bill is here is because this committee has, for the 12 years I've been in the legislature, deals with utility legislation, and I think we understand those issues back to the days, and Commissioner Beyer and I served together on this commission. So this bill is here because it's the proper place for this bill to be. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. At this point, I'd like to have Commissioner Beyer come up and address the bill.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Given the hour, I'm going to make it very short. The Commission, on behalf of the Governor, did introduce the original feed-in tariff bill, which was B-2121. That has been incorporated into this bill along with, as Representative Reed said, a pilot, I guess it's a pilot, a requirement for larger 20 megawatts for utility installations. Obviously, since we introduced the feed-in tariff, we support the concept as a pilot. One of the things that I feel I must tell you is our job is to represent the ratepayers. This is an experiment. This was not intended to set policy. This was intended to get information so that you in a future session may determine what the appropriate policy is. That was the intent of the pilot program. What you should know is that whenever you see in the bill the word utility, please mentally replace that with ratepayer. Ratepayers are the ones who are going to pay the bill for this. When we were looking at this and looked at the others, one of the things we did look at is that, as you probably know, our highest cost utility residential rates is Portland General. It's a little over 10 cents a kilowatt hour. What a feed-in tariff says is that you will pay, the commission will determine a rate that is necessary in order to incent people to put these things on the roofs and use those. The estimate during the governor's task force last year is that the cost would be somewhere between 30 and 40 cents a kilowatt hour in terms of a payment to the utility to do that. Obviously, that's higher than a retail rate, so there is a cost attached to this. Hopefully, the industry comes down. That's the hope. So I just ask you to keep that in mind as you go there. We can implement the bill as it came out of the House. If that's what you desire, we have suggested some technical amendments, which I believe are the dash nines, the dash fives. We ask you to do those. They're mainly conforming language amendments. They're not policy changes, but will allow us to get the bill and run it the way you want it to be run. The other two, the dash eights and dash nines, as we've seen them, have some issues. The dash eight speaks to, it's by the industrial customers. It speaks to a clarification between residential and commercial customers. We don't do tariffs by that classification. What we interpret that, if you put it in, is a size limitation. We probably go to 1 megawatt, which is in the direct access bill, and that will address their concern. The other one, that's basically it. The dash 10s we have not seen. We've seen a draft like you. We haven't seen the original ones. They have some issues on aggregation, which we suggested be taken out in the House version. We would encourage you not to put them back in this one. So I'm going to stop with that because I know you have a lot of time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have either now. I'd be happy to come to your offices.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Starr. Commissioner Beyer, I would be curious if you would just respond to a couple of things from the last panel, just your comments on the concern that this may generate up to a $37.5 million general fund through the tax credit portion of the bill in Section 8. Have you had any comment on that at all?
Mr. Chair, I don't think that's any different than what current law is. As I recall, there's a cap on those funds that you placed on them, but that's in the Department of Energy. You really need to address that to them. I don't think that's a significant issue.
Okay.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay. Let's hear from Vince McClellan and Steve McGrath. If I can remind you to be as concise as possible.
I will. Dear Senator Metzger and honorable members of the committee, I'm going to read portions of my written text and highlight these portions. My name is Vince McClellan. I'm an electrical contractor in Eugene, Oregon, and I've been designing and building solar electric energy systems for 26 years. I'm here representing myself and 20 other renewable energy businesses in Oregon that don't feel that OSEA is representing them in their interest in supporting HB 3039. I greatly appreciate all the effort that has been put into this bill from the OSEA Legislative Commission Committee and many others involved in the crafting of HB 3039, but the bill is not at the point where it will create long-term solar jobs in Oregon. It pains me greatly to come to this point with HB 3039, where I find that I cannot support this bill as written. The OSEA Legislative Committee has never received full support from the OSEA board or membership to support this bill without amendments and are therefore apparently acting on their own behalf. What I'd like to get across today is, to me, what's the bottom line for this particular bill is how it addresses my clients, who are the people that are putting up the capital to build these systems. And I'd like to read a portion of my written testimony in regards to that. I have concerns about the current version of HB 3039, putting further strain on the continued success of the solar industry in Oregon. For my business, what is important is the long-term support of the people who are taking the risk and putting up the capital to build solar electric systems. Without these businesses and individuals, there is no solar industry to support my business and the jobs it creates in Oregon. HB 3039 does not provide long-term support of these people. That said, I would like to put you in the shoes of someone that is putting the pieces together to make the capital expenditure to install a solar electric system so that you may better understand what is driving this market. Most of my clients install these systems out of a feeling of responsibility to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. On top of that is the reality that the capital expenditure must make sense financially. So many of my clients use the advertising value of the solar electric system to justify the capital expenditure. Herein lies one of the problems with automatically awarding the renewable energy credits to the utility companies. RECs are, in essence, advertising rights to the environmental qualities inherent in renewable-produced electricity. If the utilities keep the RECs, it means that my clients cannot advertise that they own a solar electric system. That would be double advertising because the utilities already own the RECs, and double advertising is prohibited by law. If I'm a client with multiple buildings in several states, such as Starbucks, I would most likely spend my money in California, where under their 300-megawatt feed-in tariff, California does not keep the RECs. Therefore, this one problem with HB 3039 takes money away from solar jobs in Oregon. Here's a brief list of some of the other complaints that I'm hearing from many other solar businesses in Oregon. The two-for-one RECs, automatic utility ownership.
Mr. McClellan, do you have that? You have your testimony in written form?
Yes, I do.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to ask that you wrap up and that we still have a few other folks to testify, and I have 5 minutes. This room, we're over time, and if you have written testimony, if you can submit that, and the committee can review it. I really apologize.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Starr. I also have 18 other emails that I got back in from other solar businesses in Oregon that do not support this bill and are also mostly...
If you can just provide that to our staff, the committee will get it. Mr. McGrath?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Stephen McGrath. I am the president of Sustainable Solutions Unlimited. We are a solar installer and an energy efficiency contractor in Portland, Oregon. And I'm very disappointed that this bill has come the way it has. It is a wonderful concept. I'm a former board member of OSEA, as Mr. McClellan has been an officer of OSEA as well. We supported the development of a feed-in tariff from the very earliest stages in this process, but this bill does not accomplish what we set out to achieve. There are numerous flaws in this bill that as Judy Barnes said, need to be addressed before we have a workable law here. So I'd like to point out a couple of things that I think are particularly germane and may highlight some of the problems. There was mention of the revenue impact of the feed-in tariff portion. I won't agree with that entirely. A feed-in tariff has the potential to reduce the revenue impact by spreading the cost of the Betsy credits over time or eliminating it in concept. However, sections 2 through 7 of the bill in mandating that utilities install 2,200 megawatts of new solar installations at a utility scale would impose between $70 and $350 million in Betsy liabilities during the course of this of this installation. It would do so without creating the kinds of jobs that Vince and myself are creating for installers throughout Oregon. Rather, they would be utility-side jobs. They might be performed by linemen rather than electricians. The labor component of these jobs is much, much lower as a percentage of the overall cost. The materials most likely would not come from within the state because the utility cost effectiveness requirements would limit that. So that's just a sample of the problems.
Okay, Mr. McGrath, again, I apologize. I got two more folks that I really need to have testify.
I'll wrap it up here. In brief, the only way we could support this at this time would be if it was reduced to Section 8 with the REP ownership issue resolved and with the OREP amendments as suggested.
Thank you. Again, I apologize for having to cut people short. We have time constraints, and I would like to have Chris Allman and Suzanne Lita Liu, I believe are two individuals that aren't in the building regularly. Mr. Bissonnette, Mr. Howell, Mr. Nelson, Ms. Weiser, you're here a lot, so you're not going to be called today.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Allman, for the record, Chair Metzger and Starr. I, too, was very much hopeful that we'd have a good feed-in tariff and now opposed to this bill. I'm going just to elaborate a little bit about Betsy and the way that we trade RECs in my testimony. What I don't like is that while we want to achieve our renewable portfolio standard as quickly as possible, we shouldn't do this by cheating, which essentially we're doing with two-for-one RECs. And Betsy has no cap. So we've got a runaway train already with a Betsy. Why are we draining our general funds further? We've gone from $23 million a couple biennium ago to projected $144 million, and now we hear even higher amounts. That's unacceptable. And also regarding Betsy dependency, I think that's bad because if we had a ratepayer-based feed-in tariff, what we have then is the external cost of this dirty electricity, or clean cost now, being on those who consume it. That makes far more sense. It creates disincentives to motivate us to conserve.
Okay, thank you. We're out of time. We're completely out of time. We've got the other chairs sitting here waiting to come into the next committee. 15 seconds. Do you agree?
That's workable.
Okay.
We cannot. I represent Renewable Northwest Project. We're a coalition of public interest organizations and renewable energy companies, wind, solar, and geothermal companies. We would love to be able to support this legislation. The only way, however, that we can support the bill is if the double credit for solar is removed. That's specifically sections 2A and 2B, paragraphs 2A and 2B within section 7. We strongly urge the committee to remove those two paragraphs. That's all we're asking. Very simple.
Thank you very much. Thank great you. Testimony.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3039.
And I just want to say, contact committee staff, Mr. Stembridge, via email to receive copies of any proposed amendments and any updates where we go next, okay?
The email is jim.stembridge@state.or.us. Stembridge is spelled S-T-E-M-B-R-I-D-G-E.
Yeah. We're adjourned.